There's a river flowing in my soul.
In the first part of our conversation, Megan Bang gave us a wider frame for thriving, one rooted in relationship, place, community, ancestors, and future generations. In the second part, she brings that frame into pedagogy, how culture shapes cognition, how story and place can support rigorous learning, and how educators can honor Indigenous knowledge without extracting it from the people, histories, and responsibilities to which it belongs. I want to draw on you as a learning scientist a little further now, okay? That one of the questions that connects your work in learning science and cognitive science to Zaretta Hammond's is that Zaretta reminds us how important culture is to cognition and learning. And you make a related, but, and I think, broader claim that culture shapes what counts as knowledge, evidence, science, and responsibility. Because you've also been doing a lot of work in science. And so I invite you to discuss that.
I don't know how much you know about my early work. Doug Medin, who is a cognitive scientist, is one of my dear mentors. And when I came to graduate school and started studying child development, I was really fascinated by folk biology and this debate in the field around what are core human modules of mind, right? What are we actually predisposed to make sense of as a species? And the debate was like biology was a secondary domain. And as a Ojibwe woman, I was like, what? That can't possibly be. And I recognized very quickly that we had been studying and making claims about the human mind based in Western constructions of biological understandings. And really this, it became very clear to me very early on, wow, we are making universalist claims about human beings that are based in a particular knowledge system, and then imagining mind structure based on it. And for me, I became very aware of it, and I got very interested in understanding cross-cultural cognition. But I quickly figured out that even within cross-cultural cognition, early anyway, there was a holding the Western normativity and then using cultural others to compare, right? So it was a construct. It was an epistemological construct to build knowledge that kind of wasn't self-aware. And it'd been growing for a while, and we've gotten there. And I'm not an extreme relativist, but I do believe that human mind is so complex, right? That we are extraordinarily complex, that we got a ways to go before we really should be making deep universalist claims about human mind. And I can be pressed on some of these things, but that's really how I got to this. But it also came along with understanding the history of schooling. And as a Native person, the history of schooling was explicitly about getting rid of my knowledge systems and replacing it with Western knowledge systems. And our school systems largely operate unaware of that. It's still pretty much an assimilationist agenda, just wrapped up in other things. Now, I deeply believe that I'm a science nerd and read science all the time and really love Western science. I just don't believe it should ever be the only knowledge system. And I think that humans actually have the great capacity to know across knowledge systems. I got very obsessed with Einstein for a while, who turned out to be a mystic and had all kinds of beliefs that are not well aligned with Western science. And it turns out many of the most genius Western scientists held a multiplicity of belief systems of different epistemic orientations to what it means to know. But what happened is that we believed novices couldn't do it. And for me, what I got to, I was like, actually, we're all already doing it. It's just muted. And part of my dissertation work was to ask fourth graders. And I did this study, statistical study, that did the classic will reverse order questions. We asked kids what their science teacher thought about things. And then we asked some other kids what their elders thought about things. And then we would get to the opposite. And it was very clear by third or fourth grade, Native children recognized that there were different expectations about knowledge. They wouldn't have called it epistemologies or knowledge systems, but it was very clear. They knew exactly what knowledge counted to whom, where. And so I would have been really interested in all the way from our deepest science, and our deepest quest for knowledge is to recognize that there's a multiplicity of knowledges that could and should be informing our knowledge building. But also we could have school systems that viewed those multiplicities of knowledges as strengths, as remarkable opportunity for learning and being exposed to ideas. And again, I get to this place where I'm like, this is actually really obvious, right? If we just track the differences in physics between US-based physicists and then European physicists, there was a lot more theoretical physics happening in Europe compared to the US. Or the study of apes. You had Japanese primatologists studied apes in the wild, and we put them in labs in the United States. But there are many ways to study and learn about things. And so for me, the sort of epistemic multiplicity as a possibility of embracing life is really well aligned with what I said is at the core of Indigenous knowledge systems, right? I don't believe in telling other people what they should believe. I'd like to convince people, and I'd be happy if I could do some of that. But it's not my right to tell anyone what they have to believe. That's how I've come to understand culture and cognition, and really started with some early fundamental ontological assertions about what it meant to live a good life. And then I've been able to see it in the study of human cognition across the life course and across different cultural communities, and then apply that to let's design learning environments that take that seriously.
And I think that both learning environments for young people that do that and take it seriously can create some of the intellectual conditions that you're describing that lead to human conditions.
That's right.
And at the same time, if we think about universities and science systems, that type of diversity again can happen. I think Karl Mannheim's ideal university was where you brought in diversity. He wasn't thinking about the type of diversity you and I might be thinking about, but I think he had the notion that if you bring in people from different spaces and they are dialoguing together, you're going to get greater work.
Yeah. It's been proven over and over again, actually, that you have really hard problems, bring in lots of people to think about them and listen. Right. And you get to better solutions faster with a multiplicity of perspectives.
And I'm going to now bring in what I've heard from you before, and it adds to the creativity and the ability to envision and to imagine and to see. And all those things can help people then theorize and act. So moving to another piece of your work, and these all connect, so I'm just separating them for questions. I'd like you to share with the audience some of your work on story work and walking land, because I think it really has important, actionable, pedagogical possibilities.
Yeah, this is connected to what I've said before, but one of the things is I've worked on reimagining learning environments that is for thriving is this piece about human disconnected from place. For a little while, when I first started, we were always talking about it. We weren't doing it. And a very simple pedagogical move is to say, don't just talk about land or environment, go learn, be with that. And very quickly, we've done design work. We've actually just studied parents and children interactions when they're walking in a forest preserve versus being inside in a place and really trying to understand what happens when people are outside differently than when they are inside. And I'll say one of the major things, same parental dyads, parent dyads, you put them outside and that relational field that I was talking about immediately becomes the substance of talk. So not even a cultural difference. The cultural difference plays out when you're testing memory and maybe prioritized attunement. But people who are inside, who are very focused on human interaction, you put those same folks outside, and you see a really different form of reasoning open up. So I was after, what if we did that a lot? What would happen over time? And can we understand actually what happens cognitively and really at the fine grained sense-making interactional level? And part of, I have a colleague named Ananda Marin who did some of her dissertation work on this and is really, there are all kinds of ways that people start to coordinate attention and interest together in more collective ways outside. And part of what happens is that you're navigating space together and you need each other differently than if you're sitting in what we're navigating right now is ideas. We're not navigating space together right now. So our attunements are quite different. And when you go outside and with children and adults, the coordination of activity and sense making becomes collective, in part because the place helps afford that as a different way of being. And so then we were after, okay, so let's make that the pedagogical principle. I would also argue that's core to Indigenous knowledge systems. I've written about this and lots of other people have written about this. We define ourselves by our places. You can't, we just wouldn't exist as a people without our, with our places. And many of our teachings are always connected to those in really concrete ways. And really, as I was trying to work on restoring Indigenous education, I realized that most education is about things. It's not doing the things or being in the places. And so we started. And it's a funny thing now. I think about those early years in the beginning of the early 2000s is when we first started doing this. And everybody's thinking changed the second you go outside. What you're worried about with kids, what they think you should know. And very quickly, we realized that if we picked a place that we were going to learn deeply, what we thought they should know and how they should know it transformed fast rather than here are the ecological principles, that kind of thing. So I'll tell you a story. We started out in an oxbow, which was an oxbow is a place where over geologic time, a river has changed its course. It's really these cool places. It's usually very rich ecologically. And it changes. One of the things that's cool is that if it rains, you can see the old river in some oxbows really quickly. And so it's a very dynamic ecosystem. And what we started doing is we decided we were going to walk that place with different elders and adults that had different histories, different expertise, and just hear from them, what were they noticing in this place? And from that point on is what gave inspiration to a lot of other work. And what we've seen over time is that when we first start with kids walking outside, they often will, some of them will ask questions, and there's lots of I don't necessarily knows, especially from older kids. But very quickly, they'll often give examples. If you ask a question, they'll be able to connect it to schooling. And my student, Forrest Bruce, just graduated and does this beautiful part of a study, a part of one of his dissertation chapters is about our broader study. This kiddo who knew what a watershed was, but when she had one right in front of her, couldn't make sense of it, right? And was trying to go to this school-based representation. But a couple of weeks later, you can watch her and see her next year later, you over time being engaged with the actual places, you can start to see her reasoning like many experts, who is what we call reading the land and making all kinds of evidence-based inferences about what they're seeing there and trying to understand what's happening in the system right here. And I name that partly so because I think sometimes people hear this and they think you lose rigor by going for walks. And I always love to lead that actually I see young children doing the work of high school students and college students very young in our programs. Their reasoning looks like expertise. But here's what we also get. We get awe and joy and wonder, and it shifts the affects of learning. For our work, it shifts the affects of what's possible on the earth. One of the things that I've been really concerned about is the story work of children, particularly Native children, but all children, and what people call climate anxiety. There is a story about our future that has been really hanging over kids for a long time, and it's doom and gloom, and we've gotten lots of evidence. You ask a kid, what will this place be like in 100 years? Think forward. And for the last 15, 20 years, we've gotten lots of climate catastrophe versions from children as young as five. And we really wanted to say, what does it take? What does it take to shift the future imaginings of young people? And what we have come to is a couple of things is kids have to believe that people want to change. And they have to understand the earth well enough to know that she's extraordinary. It might take her some time, But we have story after story of desecrated ecosystem that with enough time heals itself. And when kids start to can see the agency and movements of more than humans in the world, and they start to believe that humans can become better, it can shift. And I have this young person who said, she drew this picture of 100 years out, and she said that maybe people will learn their lesson and become so kind that they'll make sure the river stays clean and that people have houses and that we'll be in a place where we can take care of each other again. And so part of why I say this is that story work is everywhere. We're always giving story. We don't always think about it like that, but some view, some story about how things are is the nature of explanation. We just scientize it sometimes. And kids, young people, we all are absorbing those stories all the time. The story work part of that story, the work part of it is making sense of it. And I really look to Joanne Archibald's work for this, who has really recognized that in Indigenous storytelling, the storyteller and the story listener is what makes the story. We're always making story. And in our work, what we've really done is tried to understand the nested stories that people operate in. And in my case, with learning environments with Native children, people forget our stories were illegal. We talk about book bans right now. Until the 1970s, our stories were illegal, especially our most sacred stories. They weren't allowed. You could, and we had schools that tried to eradicate and make sure next generation of Native kids didn't learn their stories. So I've also always had this orientation that stories are extraordinarily powerful, particularly if they're ones that start to take root in your heart. I have a teacher that said that once, that the most powerful stories actually stay in people's heart because, and then they carry them with them. And so we've really worked on both helping kids understand story, engage in story sense making, but also become storytellers themselves and recognize that we're always in the middle of a story being made. And that's really how I think about story work. And I use that with educators a lot to think about what if you understood the children in your classroom as already in relations, a story that's already unfolding. You're a midwife to a story, right? To that child's life. And how are you going to contribute? What kind of chapter are you going to have? And I guess for me, that piece of story work is a really important way to both understand that stories are everywhere and they shape our minds. Actually, it's how I fell in love with the learning sciences, is that I read about script and schema theory. And I remember thinking, oh my goodness, these Western scientists, they might actually understand Indigenous theory because they seem to know that stories actually matter. I had some other things to learn before that, but I still remember that class. It was one of my first classes in graduate school, and I was enamored with the idea of script and schema theory because I was like, yeah, stories shape our minds.
So let me move from that to in effect, collective story writing, and as people create their own stories together. How should schools and education help young people develop responsibility to one another, to
Yeah.
them, to future generations, but also to past generations?
Yeah, I love this question. I think I deeply believe that learning about our past actually makes our future possible. And if we think about what's happened in the last 25 years in schooling, we're getting less and less social studies and history than we used to. There's been a reduction of children's opportunity to learn about our history over the last 25 years. And for me, part of why that's such a problem is one, we really should know it, but two, there are extraordinary lessons across human history about how when we're not responsible to each other, when we don't see each other as fully worthy of dignity and care and the respect that all life should have, what happens? Right? And those stories about our histories all over the earth, I think actually carry really important lessons for how we might live in the future. And this goes back to me for vine's maturation. It makes good sense to me that People are human. We make mistakes. The question is when we choose to repeat them all of the time is the problem for me. And I think schools, why we should be deeply concerned about whether we are learning our histories is because it actually ill prepares young people to do exactly what you've talked about, is to learn our responsibilities to each other, past, present, and future. It also reifies a kind of individualism, right? So if what we've taught people is to think about only themselves or only their own life course, right? It's a short time and it actually sets us up to make unsustainable decisions and maybe not even on purpose, but our forms of thought don't recognize that what we're doing now, we've in some ways inherited, but we're giving to somebody else. And so I think for me, expanding the temporal horizon that we engage young people in thinking about is super important. Now, I have lots of developmental friends that would say, yes, but kids need strong senses of identity. And I absolutely agree with that. But the two are not actually contradictory at all if we do it in fact, they could be quite powerful. And I think what becomes challenging for people is to recognize that might include hard parts of recognizing your one's own history or one's own history in relation to other people's histories. I often think this, I think we really underestimate children's ethical capacities. Children actually want to live good lives. They want to be good, and they have ethical questions from the youngest of ages. And we often actually under deliver on the opportunity to actually be clear about our ethics, or we squish them. It's like squishing the individualism. We give them very trite, like we should treat each other fairly, or there's lots of fairness discourse in the early ages. And fairness is an important thing, but what's that really mean? And how do we do that? And if fairness becomes sameness, it's never going to work if we take seriously a field of relations that has created the current moment. And I'm not sure it ever should. That's not actually, for example, it's not how trees or forest ecosystems work, right? Forest ecosystems actually work in unison and recognize that at different points, there needs to be movement of nutrients to different parts of the forest in order for the collective to be well, right? So if you can get actually more than human species, including plant species, to understand that sharing and that redistribution of resource creates collective long-term well-being, not sameness all the time, everywhere. I think humans could be capable of that under the right conditions and value sets. So I've lost your question a little bit, but we have to believe it's possible to live in a just and sustainable world. And I think setting that expectation up for children is the best way to help them get there. And when it's not shying from that. And I think that sometimes what we've done is we've gone too much critical without enough of the imagining the possibility. So there's that. I guess the other thing that I would just say, part of the reason I really believe that if we routinely took children outdoors, they would have a plethora of examples at different timescales to actually do and not just imagine. Whether it's understanding an insect's life cycle or being able to recognize seasonal change right in front of them and what is happening, it wouldn't just make this an abstract idea. It's actually going on in the world around everyone all the time.
It's exactly right. And it makes dynamic processes visible and palpable. Whereas when you're isolated in a classroom space, that is much harder to see other than to theorize.
We have this. I have a project I've been teaching in a classroom that's Shireen Vasugi and I have been, along with some graduate students like Corey Winchester and others. We have a hybrid class, we call it, and it's with half undergraduate students from Northwestern, half undergraduate, half high school students from ETHS, the local high school, and then some middle school students. And some of our grad students participate, as well as both high school teachers and then informal educators. And we make for a semester, we talk about educational justice, we learn about its history, and then we have them do design projects around that. One of the things that we have them do is do family and community interviews, and they have to interview elders in their family and elders in the community. And then they have to interview children that are younger than them, both in their family, in their community. and they have to incorporate what they learn from them in their designs. And one of the things that I think is so interesting about what happens is they shift from a design that is about my individual needs to what our collective needs are because we've asked them to do that. And actually, they feel prouder of it. And they do more complicated and sophisticated design work that is actually also more viable to have legs. But it's a simple positioning shift rather than focus only on the eye and giving them some practices to have the conversation. So I say that because I sometimes think this is so easy to do. It's that adults need the mind shift and to see the extraordinary capacities of young people.
So, Megan, you have answered the question you said you weren't sure you wanted, that you were answered about what is it that we do to help young people develop a sense of responsibility to each other, to their land, and future generations. You have done that. Let me move, as we're getting closer to closing, let me move to another question. I would imagine that for many non-Indigenous educators listening, they may have a deep desire to learn more from your work and from others and to create more just relational and culturally sustaining learning environments. At the same time, there's always a danger of essentializing Indigenous people and simplifying Indigenous knowledge systems into examples, themes, activities that are taken out of context. How can the non-Indigenous educators listening and others respect Indigenous people and honor Indigenous knowledge systems without appropriating them?
Support our sovereignty and self-determination first. I appreciate this question very much. And what I've learned, I really think that the work around being outside and really thinking about our relationships as human beings with the natural world, I do all of that work based in Indigenous knowledge systems. And that's just a human thing that I think should happen. But what I've also seen is exactly what you're talking about. And we can see it even in Western scientists. Lots of climate scientists realize now that Indigenous peoples know deep things and have there's been incredible partnerships. But unfortunately, even with deep respect about our knowledges, there can be a desire, there can be the perpetuation of extraction and appropriation, exactly what you're talking about, without the commitment to our sovereignty and our ongoing self-determination. In the United States in particular, it's a problem because we don't have a deep history of awareness about Native people because our school systems don't require people to learn about Native history. There's only 12 states, maybe 13 now, that actually require people to learn about Native people in the United States. And when you look at what they learn, it's pre-1900. And so systematically, people have been taught that Native people are from long ago. They've also been taught that our knowledge systems are not particularly sophisticated. There are these nice gems in them, which also can lead to this extraction that I think you're talking about. So I have really shifted to say that the first thing people should do is understand enough about Native peoples, our history, our sovereignty, and our self-determination. But before you adopt our knowledge systems, because living right responsibilities to Native people means that you're actually ensuring our right to continue to exist. And unfortunately, in the US, people actually don't understand that. They don't understand that there are mass unmarked graves all over this continent that no one took accountability for until the last couple of years. That's actually, if we start looking at the sort of 10 steps to genocide, we're really far in the US. The 10th is denial. We're two or three generations into denial in the US around whether people actually understand our history. So, for me, learn enough about specific tribes and understand what sovereignty and self-determination is. What anybody living in the United States who is not, I would actually argue for all Native people, everybody, because I'm not a citizen of every tribe. So, I have a responsibility. If I'm not on my homelands, I spent a lot of time in Seattle, those are not my homelands. I'm not given a pass. I have to respect the sovereignty and self-determination of the tribal peoples whose homelands I'm on. I really think everybody needs to learn that ethic. So it is my thing now. I say it is the absolute first thing people have to understand. The other thing that I would say is that our tribal nations have deep histories and knowledges that are worthy of people studying and understanding. But what often happens is people want to tuck it into the Western, right? Or make a cultural connection to it. And one of my favorite scholars, Scott Lyons, talks about something called rhetorical sovereignty. But what do we want and on what terms? I often think on what terms are people engaging with us? And I think that the trouble becomes is learning about Indigenous peoples, but wanting to refract that from a Western ontology is another potential form of epistemic violence. And I think people have to be very careful about that. I think people do it all the time to each other and they don't mean it. But it is a really important thing to hold on to, which to me becomes deeper demands about what your ethics are and how are you always reasoning through an ethical idea and ethics of what you're up to. And what I've usually seen educators do is they start with really good intentions and they want it to be simpler than it is. And so I would also tell educators to make sure you know about whose territories you're on, their histories, but actually what's happening now. So the next piece that I would say is understand our sovereignty and our self-determination. But most educators stay in the historical. And I would say the major thing to do is to make sure you understand that right now and what we're after for our futures. And I tell people, I don't care if you're studying the 1600s, make sure you get to the connection to living people right now. Those two principles about understanding sovereignty and self-determination and present day, I do feel like if people do, that is a peopled history about Native people, not an abstraction of us. You can go pretty far with this. And it means making sure that you're thinking about who are your sources of knowledge? Where are your artifacts coming from? Are you really looking at things that were authored by Native people? The beautiful thing is that over the last, I don't know, couple decades, Native people have been producing a ton that, with a little bit of looking, teachers can get there pretty easily. And so I would just tell educators to utilize that. And the last thing I would say is I do think everyone should be engaging outdoors. I do. We wrote a piece in Science and Children recently, though, to say that if you go outdoors and you don't know the history of your place, and you reorient and teach children to be engaged in space that's place that is absence of Indigenous peoples and histories, you're perpetuating the same violence. So if people are going to adopt some of this work, then the principle is make sure that Indigenous presence, past, present, and future, is woven throughout it and assumed. And for me, this is a real task. Can we help people learn to live with Indigenous presence as a normative idea, not an exceptional, not an once in a while, not as unusual, but as a normative, everyday fact of life?
That is great. I hear you also talking about being epistemologically humble and epistemologically creative and epistemologically responsible in terms of what you're doing.
It's interesting, David, the idea that culture and epistemology, and I'm not saying you're saying this, but I think the field does this time sometimes, that somehow epistemology and culture are different things. And they're not actually, right? And neither is ontology, or I talk about axiology or pedagogy. Our cultures, what culture is all of those things enacted in our everyday lives? And so I think it's important to name epistemic humility, to be honest, and ethical humility, actually. But it is an interesting thing about what we've narrated or how we've oriented. And it's in part because I actually don't know that everyone is ready for epistemic humility. I do think that people are after epistemic authority. And I think there's a real challenge about what that means. And I think it's in part because we don't have good relations with each other, so we can't imagine how it would be that you wouldn't have epistemic authority that are decision makers. And it's a view of inexpertise that isn't trusted. I do think the epistemic humility is what is needed. I might argue the earth is rapidly changing, and scientists have a lot of epistemic humility right now. They're doing their best, but they recognize the conditions for what we knew before are shifting. Which then means that we need to be able to think that our previous assumptions or what was solid knowledge is different. And I think that's exciting rather than, I often say to people, the great news about what's possible in the future is that if we really understand what we haven't gotten right, it means there's so many pathways to what we could try to improve. So I get excited about that because it actually helps us understand how it could be that we're in the tough times that we are, and that there's plenty of pathways to do something different.
If educators listening to this conversation want to create conditions in which young people can truly learn and thrive, what is the one assumption about learning science or schooling that they must rethink? And how can they begin to act on that today?
I'm going to give you two. So I'm
Okay.
refusing the conditions of the question. So the first one, just to reiterate, is make learning outdoors routine again. Not recess. I'm talking about recess. I'm talking about learning outside of buildings. And you can do it. I don't care if you're in a deep urban community. I started doing this work on the west side of Chicago where there were only closed off corners, right? But make learning outdoors routine. And people often think I mean go on more field trips. I don't. I don't mean taking children to someplace far away. I mean make sure the things that you are learning, you are also seeing outside in their homes, in their communities, and around your schools. And you could do it in 15 minutes a day. I would argue we should spend more time at that, but I have a kindergartner and a first grade teacher that have taught me that they will, for the rest of their 20 years of career, they will go outside for at least 15 minutes a day because it's made literacy easier. It's made math easier. It's made science easier because it's made it alive outside of school walls for their learners. The second thing I would say to educators is really re-examine your assumptions and relationships with families. I didn't say a lot about that today, but we have a system that is predicated on extracting children from their families and communities into particular kinds of institutions. And I believe that schools and education can be for good. I do. But if we continue to build them on the principles that have given rise to the system as it is, I don't believe that. I started out as a Head Start teacher. I love young children, but I am nervous about being the first society in human history to institutionalize 0 to 5. And that is based on a basic idea that somehow children would be better off not with their families. And we have to reimagine and rethink that assumption and understand why is it that there might be odds. Why are schools at odds with families? Or why would families be at odds with schools? And if we keep having these powered relations, we live in a country that has compulsory attendance. We're criminalized if our kids aren't sent to school. That cannot be the basis of the relation between a parent and a child and a school. Those are the two.
This is wonderful, Megan. This really has been lovely. Thank you for gracing us.
Thank you.
Great.
Thank you.
Yay.